And good morning, good morning. You are listening to Positively Revolting. I'm Ani, and I'm here with my co-host, Lynn.
I'm here. We are here this morning. It's going to be a fun morning, don't you think, Ani?
I do. I'm very excited about this morning. Of course, I'm kind of excited about most days, but I'm really super excited about this morning. And today, I'm really excited because we are continuing our theme of celebrating resistance and the Carnivalesque Rebellion. The idea that social change work is not dull.
Need not be. Imagination is the grease that oils the revolution, as far as I'm concerned.
I like that, Lynn.
Thank you.
I can see it on a t-shirt now. and to help us do just that, we are very excited to have Mike Bonanno of the Yes Men joining us by phone. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. How are you today?
Doing very well. How are you doing?
Oh, excellent. Excellent. I'm moving turkeys.
All right.
Well, to a better place, I hope.
Next hour during our interview. What's that?
I hope you're moving them to a better place.
Yeah, unfortunately they're not alive anymore, but they'll end up in somebody's stomach, and I've been told they're politely killed and all that, so.
That's always something.
Apparently it's pretty good, but if you hear me grunting and sort of things like that, it's because I'm doing heavy lifting while doing the interview.
Oh, you are such
a multitasker.
Yeah, I think that's awesome.
it's just work. It's you know, it's at the co-op.
Good.
Anyway.
That's very nice. I don't think we've ever actually spoken to somebody who's actually doing their work shift at a co-op before. I think we've achieved a new level.
I could probably get in trouble for this. So, you know, we'll
keep it on the down low then.
Every listener, keep it off the record.
All right. We won't tell a soul. So the Yes Men have been the subject of a couple of feature films, The Yes Men and The Yes Men Fix the World. They raise awareness of dire issues by appearing as representatives of corporations, saying things that would otherwise never be said. And like their website says, impersonating big-time criminals in order to publicly humiliate them. Their targets are leaders of big corporations who put profits ahead of everything else. So with that, good morning.
Good morning.
For listeners who are not so familiar with the Yes Men and what you do, can you sort of generally describe your work? What is this thing called the Yes Men?
Yeah, what we do is, we impersonate captains of industry, weasel their way into events that are on their turf, and then we impersonate them and ridicule them. We create either satirical performances or performances where we announce the world that we would what we'd actually like to see them announce in real life. And then we publicize the results, which are wildly funny, not really on our account, but because when you do something unexpected, you know, in a context where unexpected things are not supposed to happen, like a business conference, the reactions of people in the audience is what becomes really funny. or the non-reactions, which is our usual experience. If anybody wants to see a bit of it, we have two movies that are out. One is called The Yes Men Fix the World. That's our most recent. And then there's another one that was more like an observational documentary following us around called The Yes Men. And it's a bit like if you mixed Borat and Michael Moore together. That's what you get.
Awesome. It's been said that the way that you do things, you're using lies really to expose great truths. How would you respond to that?
Well, yes, that's where, you know, sometimes it takes a lie to reveal the truth. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with lies per se. You know, they're not attached to qualitative judgment. I mean, there's been plenty of good lies throughout history. Remember that guy Schindler, that Spielberg guy made that movie about called Schindler's List?
Mm-hmm.
Schindler, total liar, 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 pants on fire, Schindler, you know, like that.
Right.
But, you know, nobody in their right mind or who's not a Nazi isn't going to agree that it was a good lie,
right,
or that there were good lies that he told. And so, we're not doing that by any means, what we're doing is, we're sort of trying to reveal that we actually live in a world of lies. In fact, the entire I could go so far as to say that the idea that growth is good is a massive lie that we live and breathe. You know, and it's a lie because history will show eventually. I mean, if there are people still writing history when that kind of thing happens, that you know, that a perpetual growth doesn't really help us. That in the end, we can grow too much. So you know, and so that's, you know, really what we're trying to do is sort of create little fissures in our sort of the way we see culture, the way every, you know, and then try to help a movement that's trying to move us onto a different path.
Do you see your work as relating to or stemming from the movement of the Society of the Spectacle in the 60s, Guy Debord's work?
Well, we're definitely related to it, whether we stem from it or not. I, you know, stemming from is maybe a little too strong. Mm-hmm. We're definitely, I mean, as a way of describing it, but we're totally aware of it. We've definitely built on or into or under stuff that they did before. There's, you know, a whole massive history and tradition of various kinds of public interventions that were meant to disrupt and in many ways have been a rebellion against consumer culture and against the culture of capitalism. You know, if you go back to the satirists like Daniel Defoe or Jonathan Swift, there's a lot of the same sort of sentiment and same techniques that we use today. So that was 300 years ago. Of course, if you want to go way back, most of the indigenous mytho histories have some kind of trickster character in them. And the trickster is often somebody who kind of does something unexpected, changes shape, does some kind of, let's call it an intervention, and it holds up a mirror to culture.
Looking at some early interventions that you were a part of in the 90s, I believe you were an activist actually in these parts, in the Portland area, yeah?
I was. I went to Reed College, and I did some stuff there in the early 90s, 91 through 90. When was it? I was there from 86 to 91.
Okay.
When I left, so.
Some of those things happening here, I mean, were you a part of the Reverse Peristalsis Painters?
Yeah, I was. I was part of the group that did that, organized that. That was an event where we went to a Republican Party fundraiser for Bob Packwood, dressed in ill-fitting business suits that we got at a thrift store, and then we ate food coloring and mashed potatoes in red, white, and blue, and then we puked at outside the brunch, the fundraising brunch, which I think Dan Quayle was attending.
Yes.
So it was we puked in red, white, and blue, and it was. Yeah, it was, you know, strangely though, nobody printed pictures. It was all, although it was extensively covered in the news, it was not covered with images. Go figure.
Well, always a little time for artistic appreciation, I think. Sometimes it takes a while for culture to catch up. Also, there is something that happened around that time a little bit earlier, around the changing of a name in Portland. A street name that was Malcolm X Street proposed downtown?
Yeah, we changed the name of Front Avenue to Malcolm X Street, and that was in response to a controversy over the renaming of Union Avenue to Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, which had happened several years prior, but a citizens group formed that to try to retake the name Union Avenue, to reinstitute it after the street had been renamed. And similar battles have sort of been played out in all kinds of cities around the U.S. whenever there was a commemorative street name change for Martin Luther King. And, you know, any time that happened, there was a battle over it. And in San Diego, there was the naming of the convention center, and there was a group that formed to oppose that. And, you know, it's essentially a kind of a metric of the level of racism in the community, because you don't see a lot of people like forming massive organizations to oppose the renaming of streets for whatever, Columbus or, you know.
Mm-hmm. So we had that again. Hi, this is Lynn. We had that again, Mike, with naming a street for Cesar Chavez. here in Portland. And it was, I love the excuses people gave, just cracked me up, which was like, well, it's always been the other one. It was the couched racism is always sort of interesting.
Or my favorite excuse at that time was, we should be naming streets after Americans. That
right.
actually, yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's the classic. And yeah, I mean, that's the classic line that just reveals how racist and ridiculous that such a movement could be, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would be one thing if there were groups to oppose every commemorative street renaming.
Right.
But, you know, it always seems to focus on people who are involved in social justice movements, and often people who, you know, have who are perceived as outsiders, no matter how long they've been here, even if they're Native Americans and, you know, their ancestors way predate anybody else who is here, they'll still receive a lot of friction if they try to, you know, come up with commemorative street name changes, especially for people who were, you know, instrumental in justice movements in the 60s or 70s, you know. I mean, they may be able to get away with renaming a street after somebody who died 300 years ago, but if, you know, if you're going to try to change a street name to something like Leonard Peltier Avenue, you're going to be in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Big trouble.
You're going to have trouble, I should say.
Right, right. Well, this is KBOO Radio. This is Lynn. I'm Lynn. That's Ani. And we're talking to Mike Bonanno of the Yes Men this morning. If you have got questions for Mike, please give us a call at 503-231-8187. Join in our conversation with Mike today.
And that is, again, 503-231-8187. When you're looking around for targets for prankstering, how do you actually choose? I mean, there are so many evils in the world, if you will, from the petrochemical industry to, you know, healthcare denying industries to, you know, all manner of bad guys, military industrial complex, et cetera, et cetera. How do you choose?
Well, you know, the way we choose now is that organizations who want to use the sort of techniques that we use get in touch with us and say that they have a campaign and it's at a critical moment and they need more publicity and they would like to use the methods we do. And then we have a structure with which to engage with these organizations. We call it the Yes Lab. And we have a kind of series of brainstorms and meetings to figure out a project that we can help them do, and they actually carry out the project themselves. So right now, the way that we come up with how we find our targets is actually changing. In the past, it's really been, you know, whatever sort of captivated our attention at the moment. We did a thing where we made an announcement as Dow Chemical on behalf of, as Dow Chemical saying that they were going to clean up the mess in Bhopal.
And accepting full responsibility for it, which
yeah,
I loved.
Yeah, and we did that on the BBC for supposedly 350 million viewers live. And that event happened that way in part because, you know, the Bhopal catastrophe was seen as the largest industrial accident in history. And Dow had purchased Union Carbide a few years before and was basically trying to evade responsibility for that. And so we worked, you know, in that case, there were a few organizations who got in touch with us. And we, you know, it chose us because there was a critical moment and we realized it and we started working on it. And so it was a case of it being the biggest and the worst, which happens, you know, we've targeted Exxon for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
We used to, for the first sort of 3 or 4 years of operation, we targeted the World Trade Organization. And that was, you know, we were really successful or effective at ridiculing them, but we were doing it as part of a massive movement of people all over the world who were acting against the WTO's neoliberal agenda. And so, you know, in some ways what we were doing there made sense relative to there being a movement, even though we didn't have very specific organizations and campaigns we were working with.
I want to look at the action with Dow accepting full responsibility for Bhopal. I think one of my favorite parts of that was several hours after the original announcement made by Andy Bichelbaum, the other Yes Man, having Dow representatives have to deny that they were taking full responsibility for Bhopal. I mean, it was this.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the reasons why we made a positive announcement rather than a satirical announcement. There's two kinds of things that we do. One is this sort of dark satire, you know, in the tradition of Jonathan Swift's The Modest Proposal.
Yes.
And the other thing is to create a kind of what we might call an honest proposal, which is to use the temporary power, you know, that we are perceived to have to announce the world we really want to see. And that's what we did with this Dow announcement. And the good thing about that is that if you're doing it online television, for example, yes, the company has to respond. Part of the reason they have to respond is because it affects their stock price. And in that case, Dow's price dropped $2 billion in about 20 minutes. And so they had to come out and say, nope, this isn't true. We are not going to do the right thing in Bhopal. Of course, they didn't use those exact words, so we ourselves sent out another press release as them where we did use those words. You know, so it made it that much clearer. And, you know, we're obviously willing to say the things that they're not willing to say, even though you can see by what they do that they're true.
Right. We have Al on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Al. You're on the air.
Yeah, I don't know if you knew there's a movement to rename MLK Boulevard to KKK Boulevard. True story, Sig Heil.
Well, and you...
Morning pranksters!
You have all kinds, actually, calling in at times.
Here we are.
What can you do? 503-231-8187. What can you do except explore why people, you know, make these statements? But let's not at the moment. I wanted to talk about actually getting back to Dow. Andy... There's a scene in Yes Men Fix the World that I would love to discuss, and that is the concept of Gilda the Golden Skeleton. This was unveiled during a presentation by Andy Bichelbaum, who I believe had been using the name Erastus Ham. I love the names y'all come up with, by the way. To drive home the idea of acceptable risk in risk management accounting, stating that there are a couple kinds of skeletons your company can come up against, you know, the skeleton in your closet that's an embarrassment that no one wants, and the golden skeleton that in fact adds to your bottom line. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, that was also, you know, specifically targeting Dow Chemical, and the idea is that we had this, you know, ridiculous acceptable risk calculator that we're going to. It was at a banking conference. We needed some kind of banking-related product, and the calculator was just a way of automatically, you know, figuring out how many lives equals how much, you know, benefit. What, you know, where the profit versus death ratio, because, you know, doesn't fall in your favor. And the argument that we were making was that with the acceptable risk calculator, you could figure out if you're still going to make profit while killing people, and if you could, then you should go ahead with it. That was the, you know. And, you know, surprisingly enough, we unveiled a golden skeleton as the mascot of the program, and perhaps...
They loved it.
Yeah, they loved it.
The looks on the faces of the folks, I loved that part of the camera that as you were unveiling this program was just there. One guy in particular was like, you know, I could tell by looking at it, I think that'll work. It was kind of, beautiful.
Well, they like it because, there was also another thing that was going on. They also liked the theatricality of the presentation. And they liked the idea that, you know, that basically they liked that we were kind of discussing things honestly, you know, without it being a, you know, often these things are just not discussed. They won't mention it. When we started talking in frank terms about how much death equals how much benefit, they're like, yeah, finally, some kind of...
I know, they seemed relieved.
You know, some actuarial honesty here, you know, because we all know that this is going on.
Uh-huh.
We all know that we're making decisions that, you know, are about this issue. But, you know, nobody's really admitting it. So why not a piece of software that actually says it in stark terms, you know? So, yeah, that's, yep.
One of the things that struck me, too, was just how fast reporters were to tell, to pick up on you guys lying. When lies are just told, just gross, ridiculous lies are told that nobody seems to, people seem to sort of brush aside. I thought that was fascinating. Who, what was the...
are you talking about the reporter's reaction to the Bhopal incident?
It wasn't just Bhopal. No, it was, God, there were so many things that you did in that movie. Now I'm sort of blanking on that one. But where they got you guys right after you had mentioned, who were you going after? Maybe it was Bhopal.
And saying that you had raised the people's hopes and then dashed them against the rocks.
You guys are cruel that way, aren't you?
Well, yeah, I mean, in that case, as it turns out, most of the times when you've been accused of causing false hope, it's been, untrue.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I
in the case of what happened in Bhopal, it was one of our own concerns that we might, make this fake announcement and then people in Bhopal would be upset. But when we actually, talked to the Bhopalese who have been fighting this issue for now 25 years, they were super sophisticated about their understanding of why we did it, and they loved it. It was really quite interesting. I mean, there's an assumption, I think, that when somebody is a victim, they are powerless, they're somehow pathetic, there's a kind of paternalization. And we were criticized mostly by people on the left, people who said, I can't believe you did that to the Bhopal victims.
But, oh, I didn't know that.
There's this idea that, they're somehow unaware of where they stand in the world and, unaware, not sophisticated in the way they're approaching their issue. But nothing could be further from the truth. And when we brought this up, didn't we hurt you? They just laughed at us. And they thought, they told us, we understand who is victimizing us, and it's not you.
Right, like your irony hurts them more than the Bhopal gas.
Well, yeah, that assertion is totally absurd. But, that it should hurt them at all compared to the real pain and experience they've had is what they really pointed out to us was kind of a little bit condescending, even. Mm-hmm.
You think?
Yeah, well, I think.
We are joined again with another listener. We have Albert from Colorado who's listening on the internet at kboo.fm. Albert, are you there?
I am. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Since we're talking about perpetrating scams and fraud on the American people, I was thinking about the government and how they are perpetrating extreme crime, unconstitutional crime, on the people of the United States by taxing them up to 60-70%, the regulations they are tearing down on us, the healthcare debacle that we don't want, that they keep pushing down, all the environmental hocus-pocus laws they're trying to push on us. And I'm wondering how we could fight back and fight our government back against these scams and these fraudulent laws and bills that they are trying to perpetrate on us as American people.
Well, first of all, let me stop you right there and ask you, I don't know what you're talking about, but if you're talking about, healthcare, and if you're saying that the Obama health plan is fraud in some way, you can say that, but, the real fraud here is that we don't have actual government healthcare, that there's still an insurance industry in business in this country, and there shouldn't be. We should have government healthcare like they have in most of the civilized world.
Well, 70% of the American people don't want this scam of a health care because, most of us have our own health insurance. We're happy mm-hmm. with it, and we're happy with our insurance, health insurance
Albert.
Companies.
That's because we're ignorant.
I'm not ignorant. I'm very happy with my health insurance. Are you ignorant? Do you not have?
Albert.
I think a lot of the people that want government health care
just to jump
are the
in.
Ones that are the ones that
Albert,
say,
it's going to have to be a two-way conversation or we can't do this.
You know what?
Yeah, I'll just say
if
one more point.
Albert.
Okay.
Robert. Hey, Robert. Ask Americans
Albert.
If they're happy with their health insurance. you'll find out they're not. Your figures right. are totally...
Well, those are the people on welfare who don't work anyway and want to just suck off the government tip.
You know, that's not true at all. I have a great health care. I have a great job. I get, you know, paid well. I have great health care. And it's not nearly as good as the health care I get in the U.K. My wife is from the U.K.
Why don't you move back to the U.K.?
Way better.
Why don't you move back?
Way better.
Why don't you move back to the U.K.?
All right. Well, I'm going
to
go ahead.
Why don't you move to Iran? Iran has good health care.
You know what?
Oh, it's that visa stuff.
Move on.
Albert, we're going to have to move on now. Thank you for your call.
And I'm also going to throw in there from my own personal life. I, have a housemate who has no health insurance. She is one of the very many Americans without health insurance. She's just been denied the Oregon Health Plan insurance because she makes, I think, $40 too much, which means she can't actually afford her own health care, but she can't actually qualify for public health care.
I don't even want to talk about the people who don't have health insurance. I mean, obviously, I believe that we should all, it's a right.
Yeah.
Health care is a right, as it is in most countries, but just to address Robert's issue, you know, people who have great health insurance, I mean, I invite any of you to try out the health care systems in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in countries that have the same, let's say, economic status that we do in terms of, you know, how...
Or our neighbor Canada, our lovely neighbor Canada.
And then try it out and see how much easier it is. You know, if you've got an HMO, you know, see how much easier it is not to have to deal with the weird mess of referrals. I mean, all the rhetoric that's out there, you got to cut through it, get to the bottom of it and say, okay, really what's good for us as, you know, as Americans. And,
yeah.
And the idea of public health insurance or being able to, let's not say public health insurance, but public health care is super American because it's all about freedom. It's about having the freedom to, if you want to, change your job, you know,
mm-hmm.
to quit your
mm-hmm.
job if you want to, if you're doing a job that's not good, and to have the freedom to move to something else. It is about freedom. It's not about, you know.
It's also about the freedom to actually access the medical industry and to see a doctor. That is a certain level of freedom that most industrialized nations get to take for granted, but we don't here.
Yeah.
I was in Canada last summer, and somebody was complaining about their VAT, which is 14%. And I just looked this person straight in the eye and said, "But you have health care." And they she went, "Oh yeah, you're right."
Details.
The other thing that I just want to mention is Robert started using morbid statistics about 60 to 70
yes.
percent of us, you know, taxation rate and stuff like that. But that is—it's just untrue. It's just blatant lies. I mean, we're not taxed 60 to 70%. It's just, I don't know where he's getting his figures, but and he's
I
not
think
on
where his other
talk
talking posts
anymore,
were
so.
Coming from. I believe it's a three-letter network that his talking points were coming from. They're pretty familiar.
It pulled out of thinair.com.
Mm-hmm.
I would, let's go ahead and see what Ed has to say. Good morning, Ed. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. You know, earlier you were talking about, or someone mentioned there was a movement to try to change the name of the Martin Luther King Boulevard. And then there was a caller that called, and he told a lie. You remember what he said about changing it to KKK?
Uh-huh.
And I thought it was kind of fascinating because it seems like he was sort of using a similar technique, you know, where he would say something so outrageous that it would force someone to come back and say, oh, we wouldn't think of really doing that. Yet those people that are proposing to change the name of Martin Luther King Boulevard, it would sort of expose them to say, no, that wasn't our intention. We're not really going to name it, you know, after Jesse Helms or something like that. So do you know what I mean?
I'm not sure.
Well, sort of like what Stephen Colbert does. He exposes the right by talking like the right.
Oh, I see what you mean.
And so by saying, oh, we're going to change it to KKK Boulevard, then someone would have to come out and say, well, of course we're not going to do that, but it might expose them as sort of being discriminatory by even wanting to change the name of Martin Luther King Boulevard.
All right. Well, hey, Ed, thanks very much for your call this morning.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Uh-huh. 503 231-8187 is the number to call if you would like to join us this morning. I'm Ani. I'm here with Lynn, my co-host in the studio. And on the phone, we are joined this morning with Mike Bonanno from the Yes Men. And I'm realizing I've never actually asked you how to pronounce your last name and only seeing it in print for most of this. I'm not sure I'm doing it right.
Bonanno is fine, yeah.
Okay, good. I actually just got a question posed to me by a listener off the air asking if you have any ideas, any thoughts as to why Americans don't take to the streets to demand basic rights, like health care and housing and living wages as our counterparts in France and other countries do.
Well, I mean, Americans are taking to the streets. Look at what's happening in California right now. It's just that, you know, it may be that the austerity measures have to cut deeper. I mean, the other thing is that there haven't been government austerity measures here. There's been government stimulus. It's a different approach. You know, once austerity starts hitting people where it hurts, then people will probably respond in greater numbers, you know, and I think there is a lot of complacency, you know, but that's likely to shift. I mean, eventually it will shift, no matter who's in power, because, you know, we're going to see a kind of, over time, as growth slows, which it inexorably has to, and when I say over time, I'm talking like, you know, 15, 20, 30, 40 years, mm-hmm. you know, when as we begin to use up more of our resources and start hitting a wall in terms of, like, fake growth, like the idea that privatization can be seen as a kind of growth, we're going to start to run into problems, and that's when people are going to react. But by then, unfortunately, a lot of the stuff that we could fix right now won't be as fixable. It'll be more broken.
Right.
And, so we need to deal with that. And, you know, to counteract one of Robert's assertions that there's some kind of environmental hoax going on in this country, it's the hoax is that we're, you know, closing our eyes and letting short-term profits dictate what, you know, the long-term future could hold for us environmentally. And I think that we should be proactive. There's no reason not to try to deal with those problems now, because it's our children that are going to have to deal with it later. And it's just, you know, at that point, it's going to be that much more difficult.
Right.
Jeff. I'm just ranting now, but, you know.
I think a good rant is always in order.
Well, you know, it might help to have Robert back on the line so we can do this true talk radio style, because I wouldn't mind having a good, what do we call it, a throwdown or whatever, you know, a good argument with them about these issues.
Because they do call it a throwdown.
We'll see who else is around the corner here. Let's talk to Jack. Good morning. You're on the air, Jack.
Yeah, I'm not going to be the throwdown.
You're not thrown down.
No. Okay. No, but it's a great idea. I mean, to satirize political debates by making them into something, you know, putting on something on the stage that's similar to SmackDown, you know, kind of world, you know, wrestling thing or something.
Right.
You know, rather than a faux courteous debate. What I wanted to ask about, I just wanted to first congratulate you on the success you've had making this arcane satire and deeply subversive humor. I say that from the point of view of a person who makes art for the stage as well, and the projects that I've worked with on my principal with my principal collaborator, we've taken on the global war of terror, we've taken on the 9/11, the torture gulag, all of this stuff, and we do it generally pretty seriously, and audiences sometimes they're pretty put off by that and have a hard time with it. In fact, when we wanted to take a show about 9/11 to New York's, the reaction was, it's too soon, they can't handle it. And my reaction was, come on, are you kidding me? This is a place that gave us some of the most outrageous and, you know, provocative performance art that's ever been seen, and they can't handle it. So anyway, I'm wanted to ask you if you got to doing what you're doing by first trying to do things in a more serious way, and coming up against the same thing, people can't, they don't want to see something serious about Bhopal getting, you know, but doing it in a subversively, almost black humor way is more effective, more, it cuts through, people can deal with it in a way.
So, in a nutshell, what was your question? Sorry.
Yeah. How did you come to your approach in your work?
Oh, well, trial and error. You know, we just started doing it, and it happened to us. You know, the first invitation we got to impersonate the WTO came because we had a satirical website, and the satirical website was basically, you know, that comes out of a kind of frustration, and we just had fun making it. And then, you know, we were able to respond then to the email that came into the website. So it happened to us rather than having it a real consciously kind of engineered thing.
I see. So you're making satire then just came just without ever having tried to counter what you see as how screwed up the world is in a serious way. You immediately approached it from a satirical point of view rather than...
No, before that we had and we continue to do things like attend protests when, you know, join organizations, you know, when it seems like it has utility, write letters, you know, attend city council meetings. We do that kind of thing as well. And, you know, the satirical methods or the... what might not be the satirical method, but the dream, the method that where we project a dream is also, that functions in a different way, but we also do it. I mean, it's just, it's all part of a continuum of different kinds of actions, and one is not really better than the other. They're all different.
I see. So it sounds like you started out as activists rather than as dramatists.
Oh, which came first, the chicken or the egg?
Well, yeah, I mean, we didn't start doing theater. We started trying to figure out, I mean, we started as just normal, like, whatever, people, citizens. And then eventually we figured out these methods for trying to have a voice, for trying to engage in the conversations that were happening in the media, which, you know, normally we're pretty powerless over. And so for us it was a way of getting attention for issues that we cared about, and that's what worked, is what we pursued.
Okay, well, thank you. I think your work's brilliant.
Thanks very much for your call, Jack.
Mm-hmm.
And we have Brian on the line. Good morning, Brian.
Hi. This is kind of an intriguing circle of... I'll try and be succinct, but excuse me if I start gibbering, just shut me up. You know, one thing I'm proud of about the British... even the BBC, is that it's got a long history of resistance through comedy. I mean, you have to laugh at them or it'll kill you, you know. Including one of my, you know, from the Goons to, you know, that, I forget their name, that puppet show that really got under Thatcher's skin, you know, the really high...
Yeah.
I believe Prince Charles quite enjoyed it, actually. But and right through to today, but... Here, and that's considered acceptable in mainstream, whereas here, anything from like Lenny Bruce on through probably yourselves is immediately shunted off to the underground. And that's one of the big differences between Europe and here. There's so much censorship here, it's a lot more subtle, but it's getting less and less subtle. And I think you should just hammer them every chance you get. And God bless you, or whatever the hell you believe in. One thing, I'd like to debate some of these right-wingers that call, that say they have wonderful health insurance. That's the reason I've never become a U.S. citizen. And, you know, that's the redneck's war cry, why don't you go back? Well, some of us have built pretty successful businesses here and kind of like the part we live in, and I do plan to come back. But I built one up and was totally ruined by getting... sick just once, almost died. No complaints about the care. It's the system that ruins you. And, you know, that's when Joe Uris and Abe talked a bit about this the other day, and this is a plutocracy. In fact, it's getting worse. And what the USA is right now very much reminds me of living under Franco in Spain, Indonesia under Suharto, or even a spell in Paraguay under Stroessner, that you can shop till you drop, you can do all these idiotic things that keep you blunted, but you mess with the government at your peril. That's my lot today. Keep after them, laugh at them, make them squirm. Good on you. Bye.
Thanks very much,
Brian. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
I wanted to get back to asking you about the reactions that you get when you take the modest proposal angle, when you do the darkest of satires, to look at, have you ever been really surprised by the reactions of the audience in thinking that, well, maybe it's your candor is beyond refreshing, and now this is a really good idea they want to run with?
Yeah, well, we were surprised the first time we did that, when we made these outrageous proposals. We actually unveiled a golden suit with a 3-foot-long golden phallus, and we thought that that would... And the premise of it was that it was used to...
Your signal is breaking up just a little bit, Mike. Is there a...
Okay. Better now?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so basically that, you know, the first time that we used a satirical approach and announced something that was really our darkest nightmare, we thought that the audience would react negatively. But since we were announced as the most powerful people in the room, the most important people in the room, nobody criticized what we had done. And there it was, actually unveiling a 3-foot-long golden phallus that we said was an employee visualization appendage used for giving remote workforces electric shocks if they weren't working hard enough in sweatshops. And so we thought that this would create outrage. It didn't. People accepted it. And since then, we've become really deadened to that phenomenon, and we realize that it's a reflection of what's happening in the world at large. We do tend to accept a really violent system, a system that is, you know, and we accept it without really interrogating it, without asking the right questions. And that's what we need to change, and it's what we need to fight overall. It's, in a way, it's our own nature, human nature. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, human nature is what it is, but we should have appropriate rules in government to make sure that whatever, you know, decisions we're making are helping people rather than hurting them. And when there are victims, victims need to be consulted and how, like, what they need and how it can, how the system can be adapted and changed to serve their needs.
All right, we have Robin joining us on the line. Good morning, Robin.
Hi. Well, first of all, you guys are my heroes. And I was just wondering, the Tea Party seems like it's just ripe for an intervention. And what do you think about that?
You know, Michael will let us know in just a moment.
We believe we have just lost the connection. Yes. We've lost the connection with Mike.
But it does seem like the Tea Party is ripe. I was thinking BP would be ripe for something also.
After the...
Myself.
After the spillage.
After the spill, yeah. After that slight leak.
And in fact, Katrina.
Well, they did do some stuff about Katrina. But that was the one that I was talking about. They did do a press conference about Katrina that they came in as two HUD guys saying that... Vic, thank you for reminding me of that, that all the... Folks, they were going to finally get people back into the public housing and, you know, doing all the same things that we would like them to do. And man, they had reporters on them before they got off the podium just about saying, how can this be true? And also Mayor Ray Nagin was sitting next to Andy. And I don't remember what his name was, but it was delightful what Andy's name was in that thing. But when we get Mike back, I bet he's going to tell us.
It could happen. Mm-hmm, it could mm-hmm. happen just that way. But we do hope that we get Mike back, and that we get him back soon.
And that he can regale us with the whole story. But in the meantime, yes, the Tea Party, I mean, a Tea Party. There's a great, great forum.
Ripe for satire.
It is so ripe. It's a dripping tea bag. That's what it is.
Robin, thanks very much for your call. If you want to hold on for a moment and see if we can get Mike back, allow me to let folks know what is coming up on KABU in just a few. At 9 o'clock, Northwest Vets for Peace We'll be speaking with Belle Bennett Landau, the executive director of the Returning Vets Project. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, on Flashpoints, there's an update of worsening conditions in Haiti and the protests of the Haitian people. At 11, it's Radio Free Ireland, public affairs, news, culture, and music from Ireland and beyond with host Maura Cullen. So you can stay tuned for all that and more. Of course, some fabulous music to inspire and entertain following our public affairs at noon. And then Democracy Now! Replays at 4 o'clock, heading into our evening public affairs time. The time is now 8 minutes before 9 o'clock in the morning. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And we were speaking with Mike Bonanno of the Yes Men, but in fact, it seems as though we have lost that connection.
I have a Rolling Stones song going through my mind, but
I'm thinking that perhaps the turkeys at the co-op, you know, there was some issue with the turkeys at the co-op.
In the meantime, though, if any folks have any ideas for good actions, give us a call here at 503-231-8187, and we'd love to discuss that. I think that might be fun.
Indeed, indeed. Also, looking at the fact that next week it has been called for the Carnival-esque Rebellion. Again, we spoke about that on Guy Fawkes Day.
We have a theme this month.
And we'll be back speaking about it as well next week. And that is the Carnival-esque Rebellion is a moment called internationally that people can participate joyously, vibrantly, in grand theatrical ways, and enact ideas that y'all come up with, taking the truths around life in these modern times.
And one of the most American things to do is Buy Nothing Day, because as we know, the biggest American pastime is shopping. So next Friday, which is the day after Thanksgiving, is it not?
It is indeed.
And this will be Buy Nothing Day. We'll be back to discuss that and see what ideas people have, other creative and imaginary ideas.
At the moment, I know we do have actually some callers left.
Excellent.
Even if we no longer have Mike, we do have others. Robin, I don't know if you're still there, but we'll go ahead and, well, I think Robin has left us. 503-231-8187 is the number to call if you'd like
give
to call
it a try.
In
what the heck?
These
folks.
Last couple of moments with your ideas for actions yourself. One of the things we had left to talk with Mike about was something that called the Yes Lab. And this is, Mike had talked about the partnering with different organizations that mm-hmm. are at a critical point in some public awareness campaign. And when an organization finds themselves at that point, they then can try to get a hold of the Yes Men and propose, this is a great idea, this is a great thing that would need intervention in that style. And it is these partnerships that, you know, are generating great ideas, like the New York Times fake newspaper last year.
That made everyone so happy for just a moment.
That just
it was
had
really
the
lovely.
Plain truth about climate
yes.
change.
It Among was, other things, it was an entire paper full.
Yes, it was a beautiful moment.
It was.
So in that spirit of the Yes Labs, in that spirit of the week called Carnivalesque Rebellion, which starts the 22nd, in that spirit, if you have ideas for something that you are interested in doing, I know that we had talked about last week, public conversations in malls, raising public awareness in these ways. I know that there in, I can't remember what city, a few folks have planned zombie walks through shopping malls to sort of give accolades and encouragement to other zombies who are sort of, well, without real life and thought, wandering the malls, we'll say on a daily basis as a normal activity. So a little zombie solidarity.
I always like to see a little zombie solidarity.
You know. So there's a few different ideas that have been posted. I want to draw people's attention to.
Is there a site for that?
A couple of sites. One of them is the Adbusters site for Carnivalesque Rebellion. and look at me try to navigate through my 40 tabs. That is www.adbusters.org, and you can click the link for Carnival-esque Rebellions, or you can go ahead and enter /campaigns/BND. BND standing for Buy Nothing Day. Let's look at that. We are actually just about out of time. I would love to have a moment to actually explore these ideas, and I believe next week we shall.
We shall indeed.
Next week, of course, is Buy Nothing Day, and we will be back with you to discuss, again, the spirit of rebellion, Carnival-esque rebellion, the joyous nature of social change, and the fact that if it isn't fun, it's not sustainable. We need new ideas to gather people's attention, to get people to focus on the absurdity of the world around us, and to actually imagine and to envision how we can make it better together. So let's do that, shall we? We'll be back next week for Buy Nothing Day. And until then, we encourage you to stay positively revolting. In just one moment, you will be listening to Veterans Voice, speaking with Belle Bennett Landau, the Executive Director of Returning Veterans Project. Thanks much for listening.